Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We're talking about The Brothers Karamazov, Book 5, Chapter 3. The stupider one gets, the closer one is to reality. I liked that line. What are your thoughts on that? And also the thing about this chapter bordering on the Nietzsche's God is dead sort of thing. Ivan said a few comments about that, which are a bit atheistic. I believe it's always best to get to know people just before leaving them. That line, I felt was a bit interesting. So I chucked that in the mix as well. Curious to hear your thoughts. Techrific said, Ivan is not an atheist in any sense that matters. He's a disappointed theist. He blames creation, i.e. mankind, for what it has done with its free will. He is a disillusioned idealist, and he finds it hard to see any point in the suffering, violence, and injustice in the world. He blames Russia and Russians. He desperately wants to believe, like Alyosha, even though he doesn't really know him. Alyosha carries his own doubts and reservations. The difference between the two is that Alyosha tries to see things as they are, not in a normative, how they should be, way. He tries to lead by example, like Zosima. He tries to be honest with himself and others and tries to love life and people, i.e. the creation. Alyosha is the type of religious type we need. There's very little dogma in him, no hate, no real prohibitions except not to lie and kill. Alyosha's faith is basic and childlike. It's kind of a faith a child would have, uncomplicated, since its objective is not to domineer or prohibit or deny things. It's affirmative and life-loving. I understand better now what Dostoevsky was saying in his note from the author. In the beginning of the book, Alyosha is unusual in that he's wise in that precocious way some children are. He's an innocent. A nice thing to be. Alyosha. That is a good way to be. Norwegians that I agree, especially what you wrote about Norwegian... I agree, especially with what you wrote about Alyosha. Said, I am Norwegian. Sorry, I was reading two things at once. Summerstar says, for one, I don't personally agree with this. I think an intelligent person can also recognize that they have no answers, and in many ways this makes them more intelligent, but I'm not surprised that this is Ivan's perspective, as he is cynical and negative. And for number three, best to get to know people just before leaving them. Harsh, says Summerstars. Gosh. I don't know. Sorry, my head's spinning at the moment. I am Norwegian, says, as a child, the only thing I learned about Napoleon was that he was a short guy overcompensating. Everything I've heard about him after that has made me respect him, though, especially his military record. Question 2 about the Nietzsche territory with God is dead. I think the sort of conflict that is going on here is very similar, but I'm really struggling to fully understand Ivan, so I don't know what to say about it. We still don't know what he really believes or why he could not accept two lines, parallel lines touching. Yeah, that was a weird one. Even if he witnessed himself. If I remember correctly, this mirrors something Zosima said about miracles, and I believe that is what he is talking about. Ivan would not accept a miracle even though he has witnessed it. I found the quote I remembered. The genuine realist, if he is an unbeliever, will always find strength and ability to disbelieve in the miraculous, and if he is confronted with a miracle as an irrefutable fact, he would rather disbelieve his own senses than admit the fact. Even if he admits it, he admits it is a fact of nature, till then unrecognized by him. Faith does not, in the realist, spring from the miracle, but the miracle from faith. Ivan is a genuine realist. Ivan doesn't have the metaphysical bedrock to accept anything that is not within the confines of naturalistic or materialistic epistemology and ontology. There's nothing in him that would allow him to witness a miracle and see it as that. This also rules out faith, and is essentially what Nietzsche meant by the death of God. I think there is something in this chapter that I am not able to grasp onto, though. Or more accurately, something in Ivan. Yeah, Ivan. Okay, there's some more layers to unfold there with him. The stupider one is, the closer one is to reality. The stupider one is, the clearer one is. Stupidity is brief and artless, while intelligence wriggles and hides itself. Techrific said, this is so dangerous. It comes from the holy fool theory. Even today in our culture, it is okay to be ignorant and to indulge in distractions. It doesn't help that there is too many options, too many roads to follow. It can be hard to decide what is relevant and irrelevant in our lives. We are drowning in information, and who has the time to put anything into any order? We have to fight the chaos somehow, but many choose distraction and entertainment as a refuge from the deluge of information and the constant change that's happening. Holy fool. I like that bit in The Great Gatsby where he's like, I think she says of her niece or her daughter. God, okay, I can't really remember the details, but she's like, there's a little baby anyway, and she's like, I hope that she's a fool. Like, I hope she grows up to be a happy fool, because that's the best thing you can be. Probably a flawed sentiment, but also not without its bittersweetness. I kind of understand the sentiment in a way. Sometimes I wish I was just too dumb to know anything. Right. Then my mind might have some rest. Swim said the mama fishy said, in the immortal words of Monty Python, and now for something completely different. I too have an older sibling of the same gender, who's 4 years older, who left home when I was in my mid-teens. We never lived in the same house or in close environs since, though we have had lunch and brief get-togethers since. We are two very different people, who only know each other because of familial ties. But familial ties are incredibly strong. Huh. Wow. Pointing out at the end there of your comment, Swim said the mama fisher, you said, this very poignant line, I want to be friends with you, Alyosha, for I have no friends and want to try it. Kind of sad. I am sad today. Let's put that out there. Which might be why everything seems sad to me right now. I'm having one of them things. What do they call them? Awful days. An awful time. I think I'm going to wrap up the conversation here and read to you. What the heck? Alright, this chapter goes forever. Chapter 4 is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pages long. Guys, I think I'm going to do a halfie. I think I'm going to do a halfie because I'm not in the best state of mind right now. And 10 pages, I don't know if I can do it. So we're going to do chapter 4, part 1. That's what we're going to do. Sorry, guys. Sorry for the late notice on that. I think yesterday I said we were going to read the whole chapter. But there's going to be a little bit of a slowdown here. Just a necessary thing. If this wasn't a daily podcast, I'd be asking for like the mental health day. You know. So yeah, halfie. I hope that's okay. Chapter 4, part 1, goes like this. Rebellion, it's called. I must make one confession, Ivan began. I could never understand how one can love one's neighbours. It's just one's neighbours, to my mind, that one can't love, though one might love those at a distance. I once read somewhere of John the Merciful, a saint, that when a hungry frozen beggar came to him, he took him into his bed, held him in his arms, began breathing into his mouth, which was putrid and loathsome from some awful disease. I am convinced that he did that from the self-laceration of falsity, for the sake of the charity imposed by duty, as a penance laid on him. For anyone to love a man, he must be hidden. For as soon as he shows his face, love is gone. Father Zossima has talked of that more than once, observed Alyosha. He too said that the face of a man often hinders many people not practiced in love from loving him. But yet there's a great deal of love in mankind, an almost Christ-like love. I know that myself, Ivan. Well, I know nothing of it so far, and can't understand it. And the innumerable mass of mankind are with me there. The question is whether that's due to men's bad qualities, or whether it's inherent in their nature. To my thinking, Christ-like love for men is a miracle impossible on earth. He was God. But we are not gods. Suppose I, for instance, suffer intensely. Another can never know how much I suffer because he is another and not I. And what's more, a man is rarely ready to admit another's suffering as though it were a distinction. Why won't he admit it, do you think? Because I smell unpleasant? Because I have a stupid face? Because I once trod on his foot? Besides, there is suffering and suffering, degrading, humiliating suffering such as humbles me, hunger for instance. My benefactor will perhaps allow me, but when you come to higher suffering, for an idea, for instance, he will very rarely admit that. Perhaps because my face strikes him as not at all what he fancies a man should have who suffers for an idea. And so he deprives me instantly of his favour, and not at all from badness of heart. Beggars, especially genteel beggars, ought never to show themselves, but to ask for charity through the newspapers. One can love one's neighbours in the abstract, or even at a distance. But at close quarters it's almost impossible. If it were as on a stage in the ballet, where, if beggars come in, they wear silken rags and tattered lace and beg for alms, dancing gracefully, then one might like looking at them. But even then we should not love them. But enough of that. I simply wanted to show you my point of view. I meant to speak of the suffering of mankind generally, but we had better confine ourselves to the sufferings of the children. That reduces the scope of my argument to a tenth of what it should be. Still, we'd better keep to the children, though it does weaken my case. But in the first place, children can be loved even at close quarters, even when they are dirty, even when they are ugly. I fancy, though, children never are ugly. The second reason why I won't speak of grown-up people is that besides being disgusting and unworthy of love, they have a compensation. They've eaten the apple and know good and evil, and they have become like gods. They go on eating it still, but the children haven't eaten anything, and are so far innocent. Are you fond of children, Alyosha? I know you are. And you will understand why I prefer to speak of them. If they too suffer horribly on earth, they must suffer for their father's sins. They must be punished for their fathers, who have eaten the apple. But that reasoning is of the other world, and is incomprehensible for the heart of man here on earth. The innocent must not suffer for another's sins, and especially such innocence. You may be surprised at me, Alyosha, but I am awfully fond of children too. And observe, cruel people, the violent, the rapacious, the Karamazovs are sometimes very fond of children. Children, while they are quite little, up to 7 for instance, are so remote from grown-up people, they are different creatures, as it were, of a different species. I knew a criminal in prison who had, in the course of his career as a burglar, murdered whole families, including several children. But when he was in prison, he had a strange affection for them. He spent all his time at his window watching the children playing in the prison yard. He trained one little boy to come up to his window and made great friends with him. You don't know why I'm telling you all this, Alyosha. My heart, my head aches, and I am sad. You speak with a strange air, observed Alyosha uneasily, as though you were not quite yourself. By the way, a Bulgarian I met lately in Moscow, Ivan went on, seeming not to hear his brother's words, told me about the crimes committed by Turks and Circassians in all parts of Bulgaria through fear of a general rising of the Slavs. They burn villages, murder, outrage women and children. They nail their prisoners by the ears to fences, leave them so till morning, and in the morning they hang them. All sorts of things you can't imagine. People talk sometimes of bestial cruelty, but that's a great injustice and insult to the beasts. A beast can never be so cruel as a man, so artistically cruel. The tiger only tears and gnaws. That's all he can do. He would never think of nailing people by the ears, even if he were able to do it. These Turks took a pleasure in torturing children, too, cutting the unborn child from the mother's womb, and tossing babies up in the air and catching them on the points of their bayonets before their mother's eyes. Doing it before the mother's eyes was what gave zest to the amusement. Here is another scene that I thought very interesting. Imagine a trembling mother with her baby in her arms, circling a circle of invading Turks around her. They've planned a diversion. They pet the baby, laugh to make it laugh. They succeed and the baby laughs. At that moment, a Turk points a pistol 4 inches from the baby's face. The baby laughs with glee, holds out its little hands to the pistol and he pulls the trigger in the baby's face and blows out its brains. Artistic, wasn't it? By the way, Turks are particularly fond of sweet things, they say. Brother, what are you driving at? Asked Alyosha. I think if the devil doesn't exist, but man has created him, he has created him in his own image and likeness. Just as he did God, then, observed Alyosha. It's wonderful how you can turn words, as Polonius says in Hamlet, laughed Ivan. You turn my words against me. Well, I am glad. Yours must be a fine God if man created him in his image and likeness. You asked just now what I was driving at. You see, I am fond of collecting certain facts, and would you believe I even copy anecdotes of a certain sort from newspapers and books, and I've already got a fine collection. The Turks, of course, have gone into it, but they are foreigners. I have specimens from home that are even better than the Turks. You know we prefer beating, rods and scourges. That's our national institution. Nailing ears is unthinkable for us, for we are, after all, Europeans. But the rod and the scourge, we have always with us, and they cannot be taken from us. Abroad now they scarcely do any beating. Manners are more humane. All laws have been passed so that they don't dare to flog men now. But they make up for it another way, just as national as ours, and so national that it would be practically impossible among us, though I believe we are being inoculated with it since the religious movement began in our aristocracy. I have a charming pamphlet translated from the French, describing how quite recently, 5 years ago, a murderer, Richard, was executed, a young man, I believe, of 23, who repented and was converted to the Christian faith at the very scaffold. This Richard was an illegitimate child, who was given a child of 6 by his parents to some shepherds on the Swiss mountains. They brought him up to work for them. He grew up like a little wild beast among them. The shepherds taught him nothing and scarcely fed or clothed him, but sent him out at 7 to herd the flock in cold and wet, and no one hesitated or scrupled to treat him so. Quite the contrary, they thought they had every right, for Richard had been given to them as a chattel, and they did not even see the necessity of feeding him. Richard himself describes how in those years, like the prodigal son in the gospel, he longed to eat the mash given to the pigs, which were fattened for sale, but they wouldn't even give that and beat him when he stole from the pigs, and that was how he spent all his childhood and his youth, till he grew up and was strong enough to go away and be a thief. The savage began to earn his living as a day labourer in Geneva. He drank what he earned, he lived like a brute, and finished by killing and robbing an old man. He was caught, tried, and condemned to death. They are not sentimentalists here, there. And in prison he was immediately surrounded by pastors, members of Christian brotherhoods, philanthropic ladies, and the like. They taught him to read and write in prison and expounded the gospel to him. They exhorted him, worked upon him, drummed at him incessantly, till at last he solemnly confessed his crime. He was converted. He wrote to the court himself that he was a monster, but that in the end God had vouchsafed him light and shown grace. All Geneva was in excitement about him, all philanthropic and religious Geneva. All the aristocratic and well-bred society of the town rushed to the prison, kissed Richard and embraced him. You are our brother, you have found grace. And Richard does nothing but weep with emotion. Yes, I have found grace. All my youth and children I was glad of pigs, food, but now I even have found grace. I am dying in the Lord. Yes, Richard, die in the Lord. You have shed blood and must die. Though it's not your fault that you knew not the Lord when you coveted the pig's food and were beaten for stealing it, which was very wrong of you, for stealing is forbidden, but you've shed blood and you must die. And on the last day, Richard, perfectly limp, did nothing but cry and repeat every minute, "This is my happiest day. I am going to the Lord." Yes, cry the pastors and the judges and philanthropic ladies. This is the happiest day of your life, for you are going to the Lord. They all walk or drive to the scaffold in procession behind the prison van. At the scaffold they call to Richard, "Die, brother, die in the Lord, for even thou hast found grace." And so, covered with his brother's kisses, Richard is dragged onto the scaffold and led to the guillotine, and they chopped off his head in brotherly fashion because he has found grace. Yes, that's characteristic. That's pamphlets translated into Russian by some Russian philanthropists or aristocratic rank and evangelical aspirations, and has been distributed gratis for the enlightenment of the people. The case of Richard is interesting because it's national, though to us it's absurd to cut off a man's head because he has become our brother and has found grace, yet we have our own specialty, which is all but worse. Our historical pastime is the direct satisfaction of inflicting pain. There are lines in Nekrasov describing how a peasant lashes a horse on the eyes, on its meek eyes. Everyone must have seen it. It is peculiarly Russian. He describes how feeble the nag has founded under too heavy a load and cannot move. The peasant beats it savagely. It at last, not knowing what he is doing in the intoxication of cruelty, thrashes it mercifully over and over. However weak you are, you must pull if you die for it. The nag strains, and then he begins lashing the poor defenseless creature on its weeping, on its meek eyes. The frantic beast tugs and draws the load, trembling all over, gasping for breath, moving sideways with a sort of unnatural spasmodic action. It's awful in Nekrasov. But that only a horse, and God has horses. That is, only a horse, and God has horses to be beaten. So the Tatars have taught us, and they left us the knout, as a remembrance of it. But men too can be beaten. A well-educated, cultured gentleman and his wife can beat their own child with a birch rod, a girl of 7. I have an exact account of it. All right, I'm going to end there before he goes into a third anecdote in one paragraph. Oh, man, I just wish I was reading something that... Anything other than this. This is the worst book I've ever read. And I'm having such a rough time. Like, I've been doing this podcast for nearly, you know, going on a year and a half. A year in January, February, March. 3 months. So a year and a quarter. And a bit. Whatever it is. A lot. Let's say 450 days now. I didn't do the maths there, but something like that. And it's always been a great way to end my days. And even on, you know, there's been periods in that last year. It's been a tumultuous year. It's been one of the harder years of my life, to be completely honest with you guys. But there was never a point where, like, even if I was really not feeling well, but I'd do the podcast and it would kind of, like, ground me, and I'd at least be able to, for a few minutes, lose myself in the literature and enjoy what I'm reading, even if it's just for momentary things in amongst, you know, the pain of what I was experiencing in life. And now it's just like kicking me while I'm down. Like, this is so tedious to read and disinteresting that it's making a bad day worse at the moment, to be completely honest with you guys. So, not to shit all over this podcast, because I mean, I love this podcast, but I'll just say this: I cannot wait for the next book, because there is no chance in hell that it can be worse than this book. Alright, on that really positive, sunshiny note, I'm going to end this episode. Sorry, guys. I'm really sorry for my attitude. Yeah. Thanks. I'll see you tomorrow.